Fun Ideas Productions presents the Fun Ideas Podcast.
I'm having so much more fun now.
This is Mark Arnold. Welcome to Fun Ideas Podcast number 225. The Fun Ideas Podcast is brought to you in part by Freaky Magazine. I contribute material to every issue, so give it a try.
Hey kids, have you read Freaky? The magazine of weird humor for freaks like you. Freaky Magazine is a way-out collection of weirdo comics, kooky gags, photo funnies, social satire, and surreal collage. 52 pages of insanity in the tradition of magazines of yore like Cracked, Plop, and Zap. Special offer for Fun Ideas listeners, get a free sample copy in the mail, made of smelly newsprint and smudgy ink the old-fashioned way. Just message your mailing address to theslowpoisoner@gmail.com. That's theslowpoisoner@gmail.com while supplies last.
You remember them from your childhood. Hat for the Friendly Ghost, Richie Rich, Hot Stuff, Baby Huey, Sad Sack and Lil Audrey. You read them in comic books and saw them on television and in the movies. Now you can read about how they and other Harvey comic characters were created in two great books from Mark Arnold and Fun Ideas Productions, The Best of Harveyville Fun Times and The Harvey Comic Companion. Both are available from Amazon. The Companion is also available from Bear Manor Media. They are available in hardcover, paperback, and ebook versions. Order your copies today.
Friends, have you tried Lee's Comics? Lee's Comics is better than the leading comic book store. Wait a minute. Lee's Comics is the leading comic book store. Based on arbitrary standards set by Lee Hester himself.
Lee's Comics was named as one of the 21 best online dealers by PopOptique.com. To shop the Lee's Comics eBay store, go to eBay and search for Lee's Comics, Inc. That's LEESCOMICSINC, period. Don't forget the period. Mention the Fun Ideas Podcast when you order, and you'll receive a free bonus gift. The revised second edition of my Monkeys book with Michael A. Ventrella, called Long Title, stars of Walt Disney Productions, and Pac-Man, the first animated TV show based upon a video game, are my latest books out now. Unconditionally Mad and Not Just Happy Together, the Turtles book, are in production. I'm also working on my TV Cartoons at Time Forgot book, plus articles on canceled Harvey titles, and making contributions to Freaky Magazine. On today's show, we have an author who has written books on Abbott and Costello, Martin and Lewis, and soon, Laurel and Hardy. Here he is, Rick Green.
Hi, this is Mark Arnold with another episode of Fun Ideas Podcast, and on today's show we have another author, and he's written at least two great books, but I think I know of others, but there's two that we're kind of going to talk about at least, an Abbott and Costello book and a Martin and Lewis book, and he is also being published by Bear Manor, which publishes most of my books, and his name is Rick Green. How are you, sir?
Doing great. Thanks for having me. And I'm excited to talk about my new book, which is The Abbott and Costello.
Now, is that one released yet or is it on the way? It seems like it's pretty brand spanking new.
Released and there's my child right here. Ooh, all 6 pounds of it.
Oh, boy. No one. Okay. Now it's worth it. Okay. Because I saw the price on it, and it was like nearing $100 or something like that. And I'm like, oh,
yeah, yeah, we'll definitely talk about that. I think it's worth it, but there's quite a story behind what it has ended up being, okay, and what the next ones will be.
Okay. Now, do you have the Martin and Lewis one? That's like your earlier one. That's probably the same.
I do. All dimension. Right. So I have five books out. The first two were fiction. They're a comic fantasy novels, kind of like Hitchhiker's okay. Guide type okay. of books. But my third book, which was my first for Bear Manor, was Henry Brandon, King okay. of the Bogeymen, which okay. I co-wrote with Bill Cassara.
And he's been on the podcast, so I knew about that
book. Oh, great.
Yeah, and so, I asked him about this too. So, yeah.
That led to me going solo and doing last year this another, you know, you don't need to weightlift when you've got my books around. So there's Marketing Mayhem, mm-hmm. selling Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis to post-war America. And this is also Quite the Monster with, of course, their famous caricatures. Uh-huh. And both of these books are over 700 pages. Yeah. Both of them have more than 1,000 images. Oh, and wow. both of them, a third of the 1,000 images, so around 350, are in full color throughout the whole book. So they're whatever you're expecting, they're going to exceed your expectations. They're definitely over the top, designed to be so. And they're just a lot of fun, a lot of memories, a lot of rare images you've never seen before. The press book ads from the 16 Martin and Lewis films are imagery that if you love the Dean and Jerry films, you're going to start to drool a little bit. You haven't seen this stuff. It's each film would have 4, 5, 6 completely different ad layouts for the same picture where, you know, The Exorcist, Jaws, whatever, from the 70s on, it was like one poster, one image. But in the 30s, 40s, 50s, multiple approaches, and they're all just dynamic and full of life and comic energy. I love them, and I know the fans of the comedy teams love seeing stuff they've never seen before. So that's what these books are. They celebrate how the comedy teams were marketed in their era, and then the legacy into the 21st century.
Very cool. Now, tell us a little about your background. Do you have a marketing background, or are you just a fan of like trade ads and things like that?
And the answer is both. I graduated college with a BA in writing and very quickly realized, you know, my name's not Zanuck. I don't think I'm going to get a nice, juicy job in the film industry. So I fell into the promotional products industry and started filing catalogs and researching product. And then 40 odd years later, and they are very odd years, I'm the regional vice president for Halo Branded Solutions here in the West, the largest promotional products agency in the world. So, so yes, I've done promotional merchandise for Jerry Lewis, for Tim Matheson, who was the voice of Johnny Quest, just on and on and on. Marla Gibbs, all kind. I did magnets for James Doohan to hand out that said, "Beam me up, Scotty. There's no intelligent life down here." And he would just give them out by the hundreds to the Trekkies. So yeah, I have that background. I wasn't around in the 50s when the Martin and Lewis films came out and were merchandised, but boy, I've collected a lot of stuff. Same with Bud and Lou, same with Laurel and Hardy. I've been in the Sons of the Desert since I was 15 years old, and that was a long time ago.
So, were you collecting things just as a fan, or did you have aspirations at some point to do books?
No, I did not have aspirations to do books. I was a collector. That's how I was born. I started collecting Castle films and then Black Hawk films in the early 70s, which led to stills and posters and press books. So I started out loving the Universal horror films and Famous Monsters of Filmland, and I say this in the Abbott and Costello book. It's a natural leap from Frankenstein and the Invisible Man to Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein and meet right. the Invisible Man. So it's the same monsters. Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein is the last time we see that version of Dracula, that version of the Wolfman. So mm-hmm. it's the sequel to House of Dracula, as yeah. well as the next Abbott and Costello film. So. Right. So, yeah, I collected press books and posters and, you know, since I was a teenager, scrounging my lunch money to get a one sheet. I bought my Goldfinger one sheet for $3 in 1974 and still have it. It's on linen and framed. And so, yeah, I was able to get a lot of this stuff when it wasn't astronomically priced
right.
and still have it.
Over the years, I'm collecting all this stuff, and we'll just kind of I assume that something like Goldfinger, even though you're quoting a pretty lowball price nowadays, still James Bond, I'm sure, always commanded a higher price than these comedy teams, correct? Traditionally?
I mean, in the 70s, I got Dr. No for $5. I was buying okay. press books for $1.
Okay.
So, but yeah, as soon as the 80s came in and that next nostalgia boom hit, and people could get that stuff outside of a Hollywood shop, the prices did soar. I mean, now. Abbott and Costello made 36 features. So there are actually more than 36 one sheets because a film like Rio Rita has 4 one sheets. So, but let's just say 36 one sheets. I have 22 out of 36.
Wow.
I don't think I'll ever own Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein because I can't afford it.
Yeah, I would believe. That's probably one of the most popular, if not the most popular, of all their films.
Absolutely. It's their most popular film and the most popular paper on as far as posters and lobby cards. I do have the title lobby card, and even that was like $1,000 for one lobby card. So,
oh.
yeah.
Now, when you started collecting, how did you start in the early 70s? Were you going to shows? Or did you contact studios or a little of both? Or what was your method?
You're asking great questions because, yes, back then there was no internet. There was no eBay. Antique malls and antique stores, they'd rather sell a Louis XIV chair. So I was going to collector shows. I remember driving to Detroit from Cleveland, where I grew up, for a collector show in 1974. I met Kirk Allen, the first Superman. So I was buying stuff there for a few bucks here, a few bucks there. And then there are these newspapers like The Big Reel, where people would put ads in and sell posters and films and whatnot. And in the 80s, that was the place to buy all this stuff. And then I moved out west, so there were a ton of memorabilia stores in right. Hollywood that they're mostly all gone now.
Right.
But boy, back then, you could drive into Hollywood on a Saturday and hit 10 different ones, all within a few miles of each other.
Mm-hmm. But did you, at any point, did you contact the studios directly, like Universal for Abbott and Costello, see if they had anything that...
I didn't, but I did locate a film poster exchange in the middle of the country. That's where all the National Screen Service material ended up, and you could give them lists of stuff, and you could get 6 sheets. No, nobody wanted the bigger posters because they didn't have the space. So I was buying 6 sheets for Abbott and Costello, Martin and Lewis films for $5, $12, really good prices. So I did find that place that you could just send them your long lists. And if they had 6 or 8 of the 20, they'd send it to you with an invoice. And I'd just pay it and send another list. So that was a great find.
Very cool. Now, you probably collect things beyond just what you put in the book, and you probably have things planned for future books, which we can talk about later. But traditionally, I mean, you've already mentioned these comedy teams and James Bond. Was there anything else you were collecting, or are you just anything movie? So cartoons, whatever.
Not anything, but definitely cartoons. So yeah, there are certain things that I have embraced with my beaten heart. definitely the animation, anything, not just Disney, but Fleischer and Ub Iwerks and all that great stuff. Felix. I'm a huge Bond fan, especially the Connery era. Mm-hmm. Pretty much any vintage comedy. Love Wheeler and Woolsey, Marx Brothers, W.C. Fields, Chaplin Keaton, all those guys. And they're all mentioned in these books because all this stuff springs from them. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, I'm kind of all over the place, but when I was thinking about the Abbott and Costello book, I realized I felt a little differently about them than Martin and Lewis or Laurel and Hardy, in that Jerry Lewis, Stan Laurel, Buster Keaton, Chaplin, they were creators of comedy. They created their characters. They directed. They wrote. In Chaplin's case, he wrote the scores. The creators of vintage comedy, I was drawn to. Abbott and Costello didn't write anything, didn't create anything. They were a burlesque comedy team, a straight man and a comic, that were brought into the movies, and they were hired to perform someone else's script, someone else's words. They had a guy named John Grant, who was the fifth Beatle, so to speak, of Abbott and Costello. You know just what I mean. He was the writer. He was the one that took the routines from 1910 and 1922 and spun them so they fit Abbott and Costello, modernized them, tweaked them, and put them into the films. And so he went from special material to co-writing, to writing the screenplays, to even producing. So that's how important he was to that team. He didn't work on all 36 of their films, but probably 33 of them. I mean, just about all of them he contributed to with writing. So I really had to think, boy, I have a passion for Jerry Lewis's crazy mind and Stan Laurel's working 20 hours a day, writing and editing and behind the scenes. And I had to think, well, why do you love Abbott and Costello then, if they're not the creative forces behind what they were doing? And half the time they were more interested in getting back to the card game than doing another take to make it better. But I realized that Bud Abbott was the greatest straight man in the history of film. And Lou Costello is a comedy giant, a genius in his own way. Just because he didn't write Who's on First doesn't mean there's no one who can do it better than him, because there ain't. So I had to grapple with that, so to speak. It didn't take very long, but because I do love those films, and it comes across in the book. But it is a little bit different as far as the, I guess, the degree of passion, if you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we talk about each book individually, what do you tend to collect? Just paper ephemera type stuff, or do you collect toys or anything that strikes your fancy, or what do you tend to collect?
I do have a lot of collections. I have a Viewmaster reel collection. I have old comic books, but not superheroes. They're funny books, comic characters. I have every issue of The Adventures of Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, 40 issues of their comic book. And then The Adventures of Jerry Lewis started with number 41 and went to like 118. I mean, it went from the late 40s or the early 50s into the 70s, over 20.
That, yeah.
So so comic books and toys, if they're film or animation related. I was a film collector for many decades, 16, and, you know, started again with Castle and Black Hawk. And but now with Blu-ray, I don't need to lug projectors and have those big reels. The stuff looks better than I could have ever imagined it. And at some point, I hope we'll talk about the Africa Screams, the Jack and the Beanstalk Blu-ray restorations that came out in the past year or two that are just stunning. And I rave about that stuff in my book. It's not just what happened in 1943, but it's what happened in 2013 and how they're still relevant. Both teams and soon Laurel and Hardy, which I'm spilling the beans here. That's my next project.
Okay. Well, connected to Laurel and Hardy, and I said we'd talk about your books. Yes, I did interview Bill Cassero, but he's written other books too. So for the Henry Brandon King of the Bogeyman book, which is a fascinating book, you know, because, you know, you just think of, or at least I just thought of him as being Barnaby in Laurel and Hardy's Babes in Toyland.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, there it is. You know, he was making movies all the way into, like, he was in Mel Brooks's To Be or Not to Be and things like that. And I had no clue about stuff like that. I just never thought about it because he looked old, but I know it was makeup, you know, back in the 30s. And so, you know, for him to still be making movies in the 80s, I'm like, what?
You know. Yeah, he was a great guy. He was a dear friend of both Bill and myself. And because he was so young when Roach cast him as Barnaby, he was 22. And he even said, all the old actors in Hollywood, they hated my guts because I got that part. But if they had to run up and down all the steps and hills and stuff, it almost killed me. It would have killed one of them. So they should be thanking me. People are shocked to discover, not the real film buffs, but the normals are shocked to discover that the same guy who was Barnaby was Scar in The Searchers, the greatest American Western ever filmed. Henry Brandon was in 100 features and over 100 television shows, Get Smart and Mission Impossible and on and on and on. So there was a time through the 50s and into the early 60s when he was so busy jumping back and forth, movies, TV, still doing stage work. Then he went to Germany to make a terrible film and stayed there where he was from for another 6 months. And it derailed the momentum, at least in the minds of the casting directors. So when he came back, he still got work, but not like it was. I wish he hadn't made that trip. He wanted a free trip to his homeland, and he got it, but it derailed his career to some degree. All that said, he made a comment, and he put it beautifully to a guy in a taxi who saw him on the street in San Francisco. Stop the car. Hey, you're a movie star. He said, no, I am an actor. That was Henry Brandon. So I call him the not the man of 1,000 faces, but the man of 100 personas. He could play any. I could do an hour just on Henry Brandon. He could play any nationality, any ethnicity, a poor man to a CEO. And he was just great. He wasn't under contract ever to any studio. So total freelancer, made films for all the studios. And but he was never a movie star in his mind. But when he started attending Sons of the Desert meetings in 1979 and then through the rest of his life till 1990, he was our movie star. And he loved it. He loved how we felt about him. And he was always on. he was just a delightful friend. So, but Bill and I never thought we're going to write a book about him one day. That was the last thing we thought. But mm-hmm. then the opportunity came up, and he had his contacts at Bear Manor, which I didn't have. Mm-hmm. I do now, because now Ben loves me, and I'm doing stuff for him that people are calling, this is the best Bear Manor book of all time. It's just very nice to read that stuff. I didn't set out to write the best book on Martin and Lewis. I don't think it's the best book on Martin and Lewis, but a lot of people say that, and it's very flattering.
We'll go to that in a second. One more Henry Brandon question then. How did you split the work since you're working with Bill? And
it wasn't evenly split, only because I had more of the movies to watch and write up, and I'm really fast. So it was just whoever had the movie. So when we decided we're going to write this book,
right,
he said, I guess I'm going to have to arm wrestle you over who writes the Babes in Toyland chapter. I said, nope, you can have it. I just want to do the Fu Manchu serial. Well, he could care less about that. So we both got what we wanted.
That's cool.
And then he says, the Searchers, am I going to have to fight with you? I'm like, no, you take that one. But I want to do all the rest of the serials. So we just split it up based on who had access to that film or that TV show. The TV shows, I literally wrote the whole chapter except for one show, because I had them all. So it's probably 60-40, 65-35, only because of the speed and the access.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, even though it was probably more evenly split in this other case, you know, our mutual friend Nick Santa Maria, you know, also has written a recent Abbott and Costello book, and his co-author, which name forgets me,
Matthew Cunningham.
Thank you. They seem to split it pretty much down the line evenly, like, you know. But
yeah, they switch off every film, but they let you know this is written by Nick, this chapter is by Matthew. So, I thought that was a great book. Because the best book on Abbott and Costello is out of print, Abbott and Costello in Hollywood, that is a 21st century kind of update of that original book, and you can get that anywhere. So I direct people to Nick and Matthew's book, which goes even deeper, like almost gag by gag, and talks about the co-stars and the producers, and really deep. My stuff, I tell people, aren't you afraid of competing with their book? It's like, it's not a competition. They complement each other. Yeah. My book, you know, there's 1,000 images in there. Yes, there's writing. I talk about each film, and I talk about the TV shows, the radio series, but it's mostly a visual feast.
Yeah.
Celebrating the ads, the posters, the publicity stills, the magazines, the merch, and so on.
Yeah. And I'm the same way. I mean, if I'm writing a book, you know, I've written many books for Bear Manor about, you know, Cracked Magazine, Total Television, Underdog, and to Patty Freeling, Pink Panther, and things like that, you know. But it's like, if somebody else writes a similar book, you know, I don't have a problem with that. You know, just don't crib it, you know, and steal all the information verbatim. You know, it's like, I want you to take my information, expand on it, do something different with it and better. You know, I have no problem with that, you know. And you know, it sounds like that's what has happened. Now, we'll go back to the Abbott Costello book in a minute, because that's the new one. So the next one after the Henry Brandon book, and when did Henry Brandon book come out first?
That came out in 2017, 2018, in there.
Because it seems like they're coming out really fast, but I know time passes and everything. So, you know. Okay, so when did the Martin Lewis one?
So Martin Lewis was last year. It came out in April of 2022.
And let's say the full title here is called Marketing Mayhem, Selling Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis to Postwar America. Now, you already have a revised or upgraded edition. So what? Tell me the story on that, because
I
was already going to buy it, and then I said, "Wait a minute! Now it's upgraded. What's going on here?" You know,
upgraded and more expensive. So because the book, all this stuff is print on demand. Unless your name is Stephen King or Grisham, all this stuff's POD. So I released Marketing Mayhem 15, 16 months ago, and we sold hundreds of copies. It was popular, 5-star reviews on Amazon, and then Amazon pulled it down. So I went to Ben, our publisher. I'm like, what's going on? Fix it. Find out. So they told him the book is so saturated with ink that you need to upgrade to better paper, because it's wrecking our presses. So I was told we're doing that, but the price is going to double because of this, the nicer paper stock. And so that's when I said, well, if you're going to take my $50 book and make it a $100 book, can I at least redo it and add color? Because he had always said, I don't do color. There's no color at Bear Manor.
I'll tell you a story on that, but go ahead.
Okay. So he said, yeah, well, now we can. So I was right in the middle of Abbott and Costello. I had to go back and rewrite Martin and Lewis. I was doing both of them at the same time. And I got them about 350 images to switch out black and white to color. All the one sheets, all the lobby cards, the magazines, the comic books, the merch. I mean, it's the book that I had in my head that I was told, well, we can't do it because there's no color. Right. So we did. We call it the new upgraded edition with full color.
That's
so people can, you know that now I don't even think they sell the other one anymore. So there's this one, and it's like $114 for the hardback, which these books are so ginormous. Leonard Maltin said it looked like the city telephone directory had arrived, that you don't want to get these in paperback. They're just too big. So for the few extra bucks, get the hardback, and it's permanent, and it won't split the spine and so on.
Okay. So I'll tell you my color story, and then we'll go back to you. Okay. So all of my books, as yours up until this point, have been black and white. My first book for Bear Manor was created and produced by Total Television Productions, a slim black and white volume, smallish red. And, you know, I always thought, you know, this would be great if I could do like, you know, a big kind of scrapbook or something someday, you know, but I figured it wouldn't be with Bear Manor because I said, no, we can't do color, blah, 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 blah. Somewhere along the line, I don't know if you know this gentleman, Daryl Van Sitters did a book about Jay Ward, and it's a big behemoth. He self-published that thing, and it's in color. And I said, well, I asked him first. I said, would you be willing to work with me and do one of those on Total Television? And he goes, yeah, that's your domain. You can do I like Jay Ward. And I go, fair enough. And so I went back to Ben, and I said, you know, I have enough information for another Total Television book. I don't really want to do a revised second edition. I'm not a big fan of that. Obviously, you just did that with Martin Lewis, but, you know, there's a reason for it. And I did it on one of my Monkeys books. There's a reason for that. But in general, I like to have both books in print. So I have a nice black and white volume that's the history. And then I have the Total Television scrapbook. That was going to be in black and white. Oversized. It's not as thick as your book. It's probably a half inch thick, whereas yours is like an inch and 2 inches thick, it looks like. I bought a Bear Manor book about the Osmond family discography, and just because, you know, we can all buy books of other people we're interested in from Bear Manor, you know, and stuff like that. So I bought it, and I go, hey, there's color in here. So I called Ben and I said, you lied to me. You said you couldn't do color. And he goes, well, I didn't want to do color. I haven't done color yet. You know, because he was talking prior to this, he was saying, well, if you want to do color, maybe we can do a Kickstarter. You know, it's like, I don't want to GoFundMe and all blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, no, I'll leave it to black and white. Till I saw this Osmond book. And I said, if you can do the Osmond book, you can do the Total Television book. And he said, well, it's going to cost a lot and everything. And I go, what is my best-selling book ever from me to your company? And he goes, well, the Monkeys book is a good seller. And I go, well, what's the animation books? And he goes, your Total Television book. And I go, exactly. People will buy this. They will buy a color oversized book. And I was right. They did. And they do. So I'm happy that I helped pave the way. You know, it was the Osmond book probably first. But, you know, I said, you got to do some color books, you know, here. You know, it's like, you have to charge more, but people will pay it if it's something they're really interested in. So that's my story.
I agree. and I was kind of forced to redo Marketing Mayhem. It was not my plan to make people buy the same book twice. nor do they have to. There's nothing wrong with the first edition.
Yeah.
But another aspect of these books is they're over 700 pages. They're just meaty. And Ben said, can we split Abbott and Costello into two books? Because if it's over 500 pages, it eliminates 50% of the presses that can print these up. It's just going to be harder to get them. And I'm like, no,
yeah.
Abbott and Costello, it's one story. I can't split it. But Laurel and Hardy, the next project, instead of one 700-page book, is going to be two 500-page books.
Oh, okay. I was going to say two 700-page
books. No, I promised him I wouldn't do any more 700-pagers. So Abbott and Costello is the last behemoth. And but Laurel and Hardy, it's going to be more pages because it's going to end up as 1,000 pages. I'm actually, I've already started putting it together, and the material that I'm coming up with is spectacular.
Cool. So back to Martin and Lewis. We'll get to that because Stella and Laurel and Hardy, but back to Martin and Lewis. Can you show a few pages first, since you keep talking about it? People are like salivating. Well, let's see some color stuff here.
Yes. So I'll give an example, if I can quickly find it, from Jumping Jacks. Most of the imagery I just upgraded from black and white to color, but there's 10 or 15 areas where I could now put this 40 by 60 gorgeous poster in there. So I did switch out a few things, but yeah, all of the one sheets. So there's the press book for Three Ring Circus and another 40 by 60. I mean, the color looks fantastic. The black and white is crisp, and these ads. So here's another example. My Friend Irma, their very first film, Leonard Maltin, in his review, was just shocked that it's filled with these Hirschfeld images that he had never seen before. And he put that in his review. He's been collecting Martin and Lewis hits since he was a kid, and he'd never seen that stuff. So that made me feel awesome, because I had something that even shocked Leonard Maltin.
That's cool.
But Hirschfeld worked for MGM publicity through the 30s into the 40s. Mm-hmm. So he did Laurel and Hardy, Charlie Chase, Marx Brothers, Abbott and Costello. They made some MGM films. And then in the 50s, he freelanced and then became the greatest caricaturist in American history. So he did these Martin and Lewis. He did all of them. Not later when he was doing postage stamps, but in their time periods,
right.
He did all the great comedians. Chaplin, he did the great dictators. So that's cool. I have Hirschfeld, plenty of Hirschfeld, in both of the books that are out. But in the two-volume Laurel and Hardy, that guy did so many of their features, so many of the ads, full-color paintings, line art. There's going to be so much Hirschfeld that people have never seen. I can't wait to share that stuff.
Now, you mentioned, and it looked like it was better, but what was the improvement on the paper?
It's just thicker so that it could hold the ink.
Okay.
So it's not glossy or anything.
Yeah,
it's still paper, but I don't know the technical terms, but
I was just
50
curious
weight or whatever.
Because I had Gary Lassen on the show, and he did his Three Stooges books, which is comparable to yours. He self-published that one, but he put it on glossy It's black and white, though, but it's heavy. Because it's like 700 pages as well.
And I have that book.
Oh, you have it. So
I do.
How does this compare to that? Is it the same dimensions and everything? Or?
It exactly the same dimensions, same thickness, almost the same page count. Mm-hmm. His book is spectacular. The ads of the Stooges in their touring years, nothing from the films, just from when they were live on stage. It's stuff that I've never seen. And I wrote him and I said, I don't know how you found this. Well, he was actually related to the family, he probably got their scrapbook.
And he's
whatnot.
Like you, he's been collecting for something.
But
years,
when I was 14, I co-founded the Three Stooges fan club. I didn't even have a driver's license. And the guy who came up with the idea, Ralph Schiller, lived in Chicago. He flew to Cleveland. We met. We planned our club. And I just remember thinking in the early 70s, I can't write to Stan Laurel. I can't write to Oliver Hardy. They're gone. But Mo Howard's still here. Larry Fine is still here. I started writing with corresponding with both of them. And at one point, I told Mo I had met with this guy, Ralph Schiller. We're going to start a national Three Stooges fan club. Can I have your permission to do that, to use your signatures on our membership card? He was all for it. Yes, you have my permission. I mean, I have in his handwriting him saying this. And from that moment till he died, which was about a year, I would get letters every week, every single week, 2, 3, 4, 5 letters. Mo Howard gave me your address and said, you have a Three Stooges fan club. I want to join. So shortly after I helped found that and started their newsletter, which is still being published to this day, the Three Stooges Journal, I edited the first 5 issues of that thing in 1974 and 75. I decided to focus on the Sons of the Desert and Laurel and Hardy. So I kind of let that go and forgot, really, until Brent, a friend of mine, wrote to me, hey, you know, that club is still going. You should tell the guy that you started it. And I'm like, oh. And then I went to my files and I found all these letters. Mo Howard told me, and I remembered, oh my gosh, Mo kept my name and address on his desk. So I sent Gary a big box full of the history of founding his club. This is what happened in the 70s that you don't know about. You need all this stuff for your archives. I sent him everything, not my letters from Mo, but everything else.
Like, wow. I'm done with the Three Stooges here.
I'm not that done. I'm not stupid.
So how does Mo Feinberg fit into the picture then?
Well, he took over the club after we kind of finished, and he kept it going for many years.
Okay.
In the, I guess, late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
But he never reached out to me. I mean, I didn't really, I had one or two letters from him. So it was kind of a passing of the torch to him. And then he ended up passing it as well.
Right. And see, I never knew you were involved at all, you know, so it's like, I hate to say, because in the Mo Feinberg years were the years I started. I don't know which issue, maybe issue 30 or something. I mean, they're almost up to issue 200 now, and I still subscribe.
Yeah. That's cool.
I think I took a break for a number of years, and then I said, why did I take a break? They had some good pictures and good information. So
yeah, that newsletter is really
but
good.
I know I stopped for about 5 years. I don't know why, but, you know, stranger things happen. But anyway, I had Gary Lassen on here. So as far as you said, you're corresponding with Mo and Larry. Did you correspond with, like, Joe Besser or Curly Joe Derita or any of those?
I didn't. And now I'm kicking myself because I had moved out here in 78 from Ohio and finished college, and they were both still alive. I never cared for the Joe Besser shorts that much.
But you're a Costello fan, so I thought you might
exactly.
like
it. when he was stinky on that series, he's gut-busting, hilarious, where in the Three Stooges, it's like, he's miscast. It doesn't work for me. Yeah. But boy, on that show, he's so funny. So yeah, my friend Randy Skretfecht and the Lenbergs, they spent time with him, and I'm just kicking myself that I didn't tag along for any of that.
Well, let's get back to Martin and Lewis. It's good to do a Three Stooges book. Did you meet either of them, Dean Martin?
I did. A friend of mine worked for Jerry as a personal assistant. So I was in the warehouse when it was here in L.A., which is where I'm talking to you from. Okay. In the early 80s, I was in his, before they moved everything to Vegas. I walked in and there's the desk from the errand boy with stuff piled on it. They were using it as a desk. It's like, this should be in
how
the
dare they?
why are you treating this desk like a desk? So, but it was there. And I felt like the mad world when they see the big W. Mm-hmm. Oh. Then I looked up in the rafters, the bike from the errand boy strung up in the rafters. So I'm just, stuff was everywhere. And it was just fascinating. But yeah, when he wrote his book, Jerry Lewis in Person, my friend introduced me to him. He's very friendly. I was on the set of Smorgasbord, which became Cracking Up. And it was not a good night for Jerry. He was not in a good mood. But it was the night Sammy Davis did his cameo. And so Sammy was joking and just great. And Jerry was just staring daggers at everybody, so I avoided him. But yeah, I saw him perform live 14, 15 times over the years. I met Dean Martin once. He was playing the MGM Grand, 1986 or 7. The original version in the middle of the strip, not the one that's green on the end of the strip, and before the fire. And we were being seated and I slipped the guy $20. I says, "Hey, can we get good seats?" Follow me. Front row center for $20. Wow. I'm staring up at Dean and he does this whole show and it's all the same stuff. How did all you people get into my room? All the same stuff. Didn't matter. He sang That's Amore in front of my eyes. When the show ended, I reached up like a fangirl and he shook my right hand. Then he shook my left hand and then he did the other people. And I'm just like, wow, did that even happen? So just once meeting Dean, shaking his hand many times, Jerry, never Costello died, you know, I was like one. Obviously. So never met Abbott and should have corresponded with him, but you know, I was doing Mo and Larry and doing other stuff. But
yeah, how about other comedians like Chaplin? Did you ever write to him or either Groucho Marx or any, you know, I mean, they're all still around that time. Zeppo,
I did write a letter to Chaplin and I sent it to Switzerland and I kept a copy. And it is humiliatingly embarrassing. I've read it, and I was horrified that I sent that. It said, "You are our Moses, leading us on our exodus of life." I don't know where that came from, but I'm just gushing, and I didn't hear back from him.
Okay, how about like Bob Hope or George Burns or any other?
I met Bob Hope. My dad had a photography business. We shot him once, and then a friend of mine met him many times. So I've got tons of Bob Hope autographs. That was very, very brief. Not too many others.
That's funny. I was just kind of curious. Now on your Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis book, and you do this with Abbott and Costello, but we'll just talk about that one first. As you say, selling it to post-war America. Why the subtitle of that? Because I obviously haven't read it, so you have to kind of explain what you're driving at with that.
That's a great question, because with the Abbott and Costello book, selling Bud Abbott and Lou Costello to war-torn America.
Right.
Some people say, oh, so it's only the films from the early 40s. Well, no, no, it's the whole career. But the first book is post-war America. That's when Martin and Lewis exploded, came into the public consciousness. So going back to Abbott and Costello, war-torn America, that's when they entered the public consciousness. And then the next two volumes will be promotional pandemonium, selling Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy to Depression era America. So it's a series, and it's not just the 1930s. I'm going to cover the Laurel and Hardy 40s films and bring them into the 21st century. Talk about the Sons of the Desert as well. Mm-hmm. So there's a personal viewpoint to the way I write these books, where I use the word I frequently. I give the readers my opinion of the films. Everything isn't great. If it's a clunker, I call it out. Right. So I talk about how I met Dean, when I met Jerry, being in the warehouse, and so on. When I write the Laurel and Hardy books, I'll talk about Henry Brandon and Anita Garvin and Marvin Hatley and all the Roach people that we knew in the 80s. They're all gone now. I even remember telling people 30 years ago, there'll come a day when the young Laurel and Hardy fans will come up to us and say, you met T. Marvin Hatley, who wrote the Cuckoo Song. What was he like? Anita Garvin, who chased the cherry in From Soup to Nuts. What was she like? I mean, they're going to, and it is happening. It's happening.
Well, heck, I'm not much younger than you, and I'm thinking that too. So, you met Dean Martin, where you saw him in concert, at least, you know, and it's I had one opportunity. It was when they were doing the Rat Pack reunion. It was about 1987. And for some reason, I just was not feeling it. You know, I chickened out, and then it was shortly thereafter that Dean dropped out, and they got Liza, and I was like, you know, I should have done it. And then Sammy died, and you know, it's like, you know, it's like everybody has regrets at some point. So do you tie it in on each film to what's happening in the country at that time because of the post-war thing, or is it not really that sociological?
Not really that deep. I talk about how much the films made. I quote some of the reviews of the time. I rate the films. But no, I don't really talk about, and they were wearing Davy Crockett caps all over America.
Now, do you go through all the solo films too, or is it just the team?
With Martin and Lewis, there are two huge chapters on solo Jerry and solo Dean.
Because, I mean, you could make a whole book on just solo Jerry and solo Dean.
I could. So I don't cover every single film, but I hit most of them.
Right. And throughout these books, is this all your own personal collection, or did you have to borrow from anybody else to fill in a gap if you just didn't have it?
I'm going to say about half of the books are my stuff, and the other half are like-minded collectors that I've met. Some I've known for years, like Gary Cohen, who is a big Jerry Lewis, Martin and Lewis collector. Mm-hmm. Others I met as I was doing the books. There were four people on the Martin and Lewis book that opened up their archives to me. If I couldn't remember, what's this from? One of the girls would know. They were awesome. And I had a few Abbott and Costello people. With Martin and Lewis, I owned all the press books, but they only made 16 films. Abbott and Costello made 36 films.
Right.
I had maybe half the press books, and I needed as much of that material as I could find. So Stan Taffel, a local collector, he runs the Cinecon, hooked me up with a guy on the East Coast, Ray Fiola, and a guy out here, and they both opened up their press book collections to me. Ray was scanning hundreds of pages of press books, sheet music, record labels. It's all in there. And they all get credit. I couldn't have done these books without the other collectors opening up their archives to me. And I'm going to need that help for Laurel and Hardy, because I hardly have any press books on those guys. They're very hard to find, and they're very expensive. So again, Stan has connected me with Ray. Again, has several of the Laurel and Hardy press books. A few other people have other ones. So I'm slowly getting what I need to produce a super cool book. But if anyone out there has Laurel and Hardy press books, please connect with me.
How far back do press books go? I never really thought about that. I mean, do they go back to the invention of film, or is it like, was there?
I've seen press books, nice multi-page press books from the 20s. So they're from at least the early 20s, if not the later teens.
Mm-hmm.
And then they stopped, probably around the early to mid 90s, I'm gonna say.
Well, I know they had them in the mid 90s because I have like Casper and Richie Rich because I'm
yeah.
And stuff. So they're still doing them in the mid 90s, but probably definitely by the 21st century, everything, whether they probably put it just on a disc or something, or
they have a press sheet in a folder and it's just
send
a
you
few
link
ads
or something.
And,
yeah,
they don't do three sheets anymore. They don't do so many of those poster sizes. Even lobby cards are
lobby cards stopped way back. I think it was like in the early 80s, on lobby cards.
Yeah.
I think it was like Star Trek 3 or something like that. Something like that was the last.
I have Star Trek 3 lobby cards, and I think I've even seen Star Trek.
Okay. It's one of those that I think was something. One of those is like the last one. I could be wrong. It may not be Star Trek at all, but it's around that era. And I don't have all my stuff in front of me. And it's like, let's see. What else can I ask about Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis? Was there anything that you didn't already know in doing the research for this book? Or you can say it about the Abbey Costello book or any of the books, that when you were working on it, you said, wow, I never knew this, and now I figured this out, or whatever.
I don't want to sound like I'm this know-it-all or pompous about it, but not really.
Well, there may not be. I know that, going back to the Gary Lassen book, and I even asked him about this, and now I've read it, so now I know what it's about. It used to be that, we're talking about Joe Besser, that, there was supposedly one appearance of that trio that, was on stage. Well, it turned out to be false, and Gary Lassen figured it out after, doing a lot of research. So, and he goes, I never knew that, and so that's why I was wondering if there's any sort of similar, like, aha moment. Probably not, but,
Stooges book was a revelation to me because I had no idea they did that many stage appearances.
Well, I didn't either,
He even says they spent more time on stage than they did in front of the film cameras.
Yeah.
That boggles my mind.
Yeah.
But as far as Abbott and Costello, Martin and Lewis, Laurel and Hardy, I've been studying them my whole life. No, I can't say that I discovered anything, but for instance, I came across these just gorgeous notepads that, I'd find merchandise that I didn't know existed and snatch it up and put it in the book. Jerry Lewis made a ton of recordings for Capitol. He was under contract just like Dean Martin was, but his records were for kids or silly novelty.
Well, until
records.
He did Just Sings,
Well, and then he did that right after they broke up and had a huge hit with that.
Right.
Rockabye's was a number one or maybe a number two. It was massive.
Yeah. In some people would argue, especially with the Nutty Professor, that Jerry kind of wanted to become Dean once they split up, and that would be like, it's kind of rumored that that was the Jekyll and Hyde of him and Dean Martin. I don't know how accurate it is. It's but
I mean,
it's a thought, you know.
That is rumored, and there's validity to it. But Jerry explains it. No, that wasn't what I was thinking. Yeah. Buddy Love is the dark side of my personality. Having met Jerry there, that Buddy Love guy was there a lot. And that's one of the reasons he's such a polarizing figure. Most people love Laurel and Hardy, love Abbott Costello. Martin and Lewis, because of Jerry Lewis, you either love him or you hate him. There's just no in between.
I know people who hate him, and I know people who love him. Right. I've always liked Jerry Lewis. I didn't think he was the best comedian in the world because sometimes I thought he overdid it. But, you know, I used to watch the telethon all the time, you know.
Every year, anytime
the movies came on TV, I'd watch them. And, you know, I have virtually all of them on DVD. I think there's a couple that are still elusive to me because, like, Three Ring Circus is
the one.
You have to get, like, an import. But I do have a downloaded copy that I got off YouTube. So I do have too. Anyway, but do you cover other things? You know, you showed some record albums and things like that. So do you cover their full discography and, you know, appearances on radio and television as well? Or do you just cover the movies?
There's a chapter called Radio Television where it talks about their radio show. And then it talks about their Colgates. Yes. There's a chapter called Stage filled with incredible ads and stuff that you've never seen before.
So cool. You did your homework. I'm impressed.
I mean, here's just a fantastic ad for a state fair that they were at. And just as the book was going to press, I came across this ad and I'm like, oh, that's got to go in. Pull this and put this ad in. And it's a full page. It's just gorgeous.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that cool? I mean, nobody's seen that. And they were with June Christie on this 2 week bill. So there are chapters for all that stuff in the Martin and Lewis book. Okay. And some people have written that the stage chapter was a revelation because we've all seen the movies. We've seen the Colgate kinescopes, but you can't watch them do a live stage show, but you can read about it and look at the ads and just feel the energy from the imagery. With Abbott and Costello, there is no recordings chapter. There is no solo chapters for them, but that's good because there's 36 films, so that filled up all those pages.
Don't talk about the 30-foot Bride of Candy Rock.
I do, but it's in the back called the last section, because there's one film that Abbott and/or Costello made after the team split. That's it. And then The World of Abbott and Costello, the compilation film. So yes, that stuff is covered, and the ads that promoted those pictures are in the Abbott and Costello book. But it's a little different because they don't have that stuff, but other stuff more than made up for it. And I'm very proud of Advertising Anarchy. I think because I did Martin and Lewis first, it helped me make this a better book. It's laid out better. I think the writing
show some samples on that one. So
all right. There's a bit of It Ain't Hey. We got a lobby card and some of the ads, some of the publicity stills. Here come the co-eds, a couple of the half sheets, a dippy loma that moviegoers would get, like a funny little diploma thing. So there's fun stuff like that throughout here. Mm-hmm. Here's the little giant press book cover and the inside of the press book.
Yeah.
And this guy, Jack Kaprolak, is the guy who did the incredible construction paper artwork for MGM films. So he did this for Rio Rita. He did the Philadelphia Story, a bunch of MGM films. But then he did line art for Little Giant. So this is the same guy doing fine line art. And then United Artists hired him for Africa Screams. So he did three different studios for Abbott and Costello, lending his talents to their images.
Cool.
Yeah, seems I told like you I'd bring some show and tell.
Seems like, did he do one of the Tracy Hepburn films at least?
Yes, yeah, okay. He did. Right. Exactly.
Right. Okay.
I very don't distinctive style.
Yeah.
So Jacques Caprelic. Like
yeah. Okay. All right. So at least I know what I'm talking about.
But then let me show you.
All right.
In the section on radio television, I worked with an artist who helped me restore ads from newspapers, wow, TV guides for the Colgate Comedy Hour, for the half hour Abbott and Costello show. People mm-hmm. haven't seen this stuff, and in this restored quality, they just look spectacular in the book.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you didn't have to rely like completely on something like, say, newspapers.com, where sometimes the images are kind of murky or muddy or just bad.
Correct. Know? If they look bad, I cut it or I tried to figure out how to restore it.
Yeah.
With this, I've got this secret weapon, and he's working on stuff for the Laurel and Hardy book now, restoring old newspaper ads, because I'm going to have to rely on those in many cases. Yeah. And, you know, resetting type in the exact same font and font size, it just brings that stuff to life. Mm-hmm. And I love sharing that stuff.
Very cool. All right. I just kind of curious, just because I did this with Nick when he was talking about his Abbott and Costello book. Do you have a favorite Abbott and Costello movie?
I do. With the Martin and Lewis films, I ranked them 1 through 16. With Abbott and Costello, there's triple the number.
Right.
And I make the point is Hit the Ice really better than Here Come the Coeds? So I ranked the top 10 mm-hmm. and then the bottom 6 and then put everything else in the middle. Mm-hmm. So the way it broke out is in my top 10. I mean, I'm not that different from the rest of humanity. Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein is the crown jewel in their filmography. It's mm-hmm. their greatest film. But right with that one is Wistful Widow of Wagon Gap and The Time of Their Lives. They made them all back to back with one low budget detour. Yeah. But literally right in the middle of their careers is their three best films. Mm-hmm. Stuff like Buck Privates in the Navy, Hold That Ghost, Who Done It, that they're all in the top 10. Great, yeah. great, great stuff. Yeah. But down at the bottom, Dance With Me, Henry, I think is their worst film.
Hmm.
It's not even a comedy. It's a film noir dramedy. In one regard, I'm agreeing with Nick Santamaria that Meet Jekyll and Hyde is not very good. I have memories of loving it as a kid. You know, Boris Karloff's in it. There's monsters. But it's just not funny.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's and when you watch it as an adult, at least in my mind, it seems to keep going on and on and on. And it may only be 90 minutes for all I know, but it just seems to go on forever. It's like with the monsters running around, them getting scared, you know, it's like.
So we've also got Abbott and Costello in Hollywood, I think, is one of their worst films. Little Giant is tough to get through. Even Rio Rita.
Yeah.
It's they had made so many great Universal films, and then that was a reset button. They were supporting players in their own starring film, just like their very first film, One Night in the Tropics, which I got to mention this because this I did discover and it shocked the hell out of me. I own the original press book for One Night in the Tropics, and I've got to show it to you. You're just not going to believe it. In the press book, for all the world to see, Universal mixed up which one was Abbott and which one was Costello. They didn't even know who was who. When I saw that, I thought, that's going in the book. That's horrifying. How do you do
see,
that?
You did discover something.
There you go.
Now, you mentioned a film that I won't say it's their best film, but I have a I would say it's my favorite film of theirs, which is Little Giant, and you are showing artwork from it and everything. But I will say why I liked it. I've had this conversation with Nick, and he says, you know, I like it, you know, but it's not his favorite. His is Frankenstein as well. Little Giant for me is, I was a sales rep for many, many years. Now, I didn't sell vacuum cleaners, but I understood selling, and it's like, and it quotas. It just resonated with me. And I also love Margaret Dumont. So I said, you know, I like, you know, the fact that she appears with every like major comedian. It seems
everyone,
like,
yeah.
You know, somewhere along the line, I said, well, that, you know, it's a soft spot for me. You know,
that's cool. I agree with that.
Yeah,
but it's not an Abbott and Costello film. It's a Lou Costello film with Bud Abbott playing two supporting parts.
Yeah.
And they really schmaltz up the pathos. It's just a little over the top for me. But everything they got wrong with Little Giant, the very next film, because they were two back-to-back experimental films. And the next one was The Time of Their Lives. Another
really
one where
they're not
together exactly, but that's a masterpiece.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't disagree with most of the ratings. I mean, I would say, like, you know, Night in the Tropics is probably down there, you know, even though it's their debut film, you know, it's just like, you know. I would say their batting average was pretty good.
It was.
You know? And actually, I would say it's better than Martin and Lewis. You know, I think Martin and Lewis's best films were not together. You know, but do you have a favorite of theirs?
Yeah, I don't agree with that. I love the although some of their films are terrible, but like Three Ring Circus, I show no mercy to that one.
Yeah,
but
I just wanted a copy of it. I didn't say it was.
Oh
yes,
I needed a copy too.
Yeah.
I think Sailor Beware is their funniest film, but Living It Up is their best film.
Okay. I think I always like, and now I'm forgetting the name of it. You'll help me. Is the one? It's the comic book one, you know, where
Artists and Models.
Thank you. I don't know why it slipped my mind, but you know, I think I have a soft spot for it because of being such a comic book nerd, comic book fan all these years and everything like that. And there's a few choice scenes in, you know, and Shirley MacLaine's in, you know, and doing her thing and everything. So you know, it's cool, but. I think overall, I tend to like my favorite Jerry Lewis movie of all is The Geisha Boy. I just tend to really like the Tashlin films, and I think that was...
Yes. Oh, I agree.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, you know, as much as I'd say, you know, this would be better with Dean Martin, it's like, meh, you know, and I even think, you know, it's like, you know, when you watch Dean Martin films, it's like, you know, some of those more dramatic films that he did, not where he got really silly, you know, in his own films, I think are better than some of the team-up films. But, you know,
I will say, kind of retracting my previous statement, when I did the Marketing Mayhem book on Martin and Lewis, I knew all the Jerry Lewis films intimately, but half of Dean Martin's solo films I had never even seen. So I had to watch them all for the book, and I discovered films that now I adore. He made a film with Tony Curtis called Who Was That Lady? And it starts out kind of silly, but then it gets so far over the top. It goes so much further than I thought it was going to go. It's surprising and it's goofy. I mean, I love that film. I'd never seen it before.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd seen the Matt Helm movies and Airport, you know, a few other things, but he made three films with John Wayne and Rio Bravo is a masterpiece, but he made 8 or 10 Westerns and they're all good.
Yeah.
Some of them are really good. He made a film called Something Big. I never even heard of it.
I don't know.
And
I
it's, I'm watching this movie and it's a comedy Western, and he's very funny. And it's all about this gun. He's got to get this big Gatling gun to trade it for something. And it, cause he's out for that something big. And it's so good. Never
thought. Are all these films readily available on home video?
Pretty much, yes. There were actually one or two that I couldn't find. He did one with Elizabeth Montgomery, who's been sleeping in my bed. I couldn't find it. I haven't seen it to this day. And I've got stuff in the book, like press book ads from it, but I just never saw it.
Because I know some of his movies weren't highly regarded, and I don't even know if they made them onto home video. You know, like, what's the first one he did after they split up? I always forget that one, but I've heard that one.
Oh, yeah, the one in Rome. I'm blanking, but I can
isn't
just...
it like 10,000 bedrooms or something?
Yeah, that's it. Sorry. Okay. 10,000 bedrooms.
Okay,
and
thank you.
Not that good.
Yeah.
It's not that
and
good.
I've seen it before, but it's been years. But I watched it just because I was kind of curious. It's like, well, let's see what Dean did, you know, at least at that point. You know, I had seen other Dean Martin movies, you know, but, you know, I wanted to see the first one because, you know, obviously Jerry's a delicate delinquent.
Delicate delinquent. And, which, you know, see that, that's a good one.
You can see where Dean could have been, you know, and it ended up being Darren McGavin, although, you know, Dean would have been really, unless they expanded Jerry's role once Dean wasn't part of the picture. I don't know, you know.
That was supposed to be the 17th Martin and Lewis film, and Dean's like, I'm not playing a cop.
Yeah, but I bet I wonder if there's more to it, that his role was gradually shrinking in these Jerry Lewis
Could
Dean Martin
be.
Vehicles. Yeah. You know, it's like, because, you know, we mentioned Three Ring Circus. That's a Jerry movie pretty much. You know, it's like, and Dean's like, why am I even here?
They re-released that in the 70s as Jericho the Wonder Clown, and they cut Dean's one song, because he sings one with Jerry, but his one solo song, It's a Big Wide Wonderful World, maybe for copyright, but that just turns it into a Jerry Lewis movie that Dean's in a few scenes.
They probably just cut for time, you know. I was talking about this on another podcast with Greg Airbar, and we were talking about Bedknobs and Broomsticks when they reissued the Disney cartoon. Well, it's not a cartoon, live action cartoon. Mm-hmm. When they reissued it in 1979, they just cut, and it was mainly cutting for time more than songs. It's horrible.
I did not know.
Yeah,
that.
So fortunately, on video, they restored most of it, you know, the way it should be. But anyway, but I think they commonly did that. I know Jerry Lewis had his cinemas in the early 70s and things like that. And I don't know if he aired or ran Jericho there, but if he did, he probably was like, let's cut Dean out.
I think by the time Jericho came out, those cinemas were no more. They were just lasted a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Do you talk about that in the book, or little oddball things like that? Or
I don't cover the cinemas, but I do have a one sheet for Jericho the Wonder Clown.
Okay, there you go. Okay, I know you can't put everything if it's 700 pages. I mean, you know, like we're saying, you know, it's like, it's just, I have to get these because, you know, like,
you'll love them.
After, you know, reading the Gary Lassen thing, it's like, you know, it's like, yeah, this is like a big mammoth book, but it's almost the be-all, end-all. You know, it's like you wouldn't want any more. You know, it's like if it isn't in here, it's not even worth putting it. It's like, you know, here's a sandwich Jerry ate once or something. You know, I don't know. Anyway, so going to the as-yet-unreleased Laurel and Hardy book. Do you have any kind of sneak preview other than what you've told us?
Just in case you asked me, I did pull a few things. their masterpiece, Sons of the Desert. So there's a window card. And this is what the press book cover looks like.
Wow. Okay.
And then there's the title lobby card and one of the half sheets. Mm-hmm. So this, like the other two, will be full color and black and white. So there's a couple more lobby cards. Mm-hmm. And then we get into the advertising that there's huge ads that were from opening day. Mm-hmm. And then smaller ads. There's another full pager there. Mm-hmm. But then there's a great Hirschfeld. From 1933, a small ad. And so it's going to have all this stuff in it that most people have never seen. Mm-hmm. right from the Sons of the Desert press book.
Although I'll have to say that caricature of Laurel, they gave him his nose is a little too big. Not Hirschfeld's, but one of the other ones that you're showing. On
Laurel is surprisingly hard to draw. So yeah. There's the kids could fill in their own faces of Laurel and Hardy and Charlie Chase. Yeah. And there's some other ads that aren't even in the press book, but were regionally produced advertising.
Hmm.
So it's just there's your own paper fez that you can build. This is
definitely put that in there.
Oh yeah, these are layout pages from the book. Uh-huh. I do my own layouts. I don't have someone else do it.
Was a question I was going to say. I'll ask him, since you're laying it out. How long does it take you to do this?
So these are reissue ads from the 50s, where whoever did these never saw the film and just pulled images from Bohunks or the Flying Deuces thinking, oh, it's got to be a Foreign Legion picture. And of course it's not.
Right.
So then publicity stills and just, you know, that's what the chapters are filled with. And then I'll just talk about brief plot synopsis, how much the film's made. And I analyze the advertising. Mm-hmm. Like with Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, Universal blew it. Most of the posters for that film, the monsters are in the background. The Wolfman sticking his head out of a window. Well, who made those decisions? The monsters should be front, center, and menacing like in Meet the Mummy or Meet Jekyll and Hyde. Those are beautiful posters. But Frankenstein, their best film, the ad layouts are very disappointing. And so I point that stuff out.
Right.
I talk about the lobby card sets and so on.
Now what I was asking is, when you're doing the layouts for these books, how long does it take you? Like, let's just say Martin and Lewis, how long did it take you to lay out all those images?
A year,
okay. And the same for Abbott and Costello, about a year?
A year.
Yeah, okay. And probably Laurel and Hardy is going to be a couple of years, I guess.
Well, they're shorter books, and there's two of them, so I'm going to say a year.
Okay, all right, very good. Yeah. Well, I appreciate the work you do. I have to get these, like I said. So,
and I'm not retired. I work for Halo Branded Solutions. 5 days a week, 12 hours a day, spills over into the weekends. So I'm cramming my work on these books. I don't do it at night. I'm too wiped out. It's on the weekends. So 52 weekends. Did we lose our sound?
No, we're fine.
Oh, 52 weekends working on these books because I don't have time during the week. Imagine if I was retired. I could do 20 of these.
I could dash these off. I guess the inevitable question before we wrap up is, beyond Laurel and Hardy, are there plans for more? You don't have to disclose anything. Are you going to try a different type of thing?
I have thoughts. I like this format that I've come up with, focusing on the marketing and the press book advertising. Mm-hmm. So I have two ideas that are not comedy related. One is James Bond in the 60s. So Dr. No through Diamonds Are Forever.
Okay.
And I have all those press books, all the one sheets, I have everything. I won't need to borrow anything on that one. And then the other one is Universal International in the 50s, the Mole People, The Incredible Shrinking Man, Revenge of the Creature, all that stuff. I have a lot of those press books. One or both of those might be coming after the two volume Laurel and Hardy set, depending on how long I live.
Yeah. Well, I hope you stay young and healthy and continue to turn out the good work.
Thank you.
All right. So we'll wrap it up here, but I always give the guest an opportunity to re-promote everything. So the questions are, tell us, just re-promote your books and where they can buy them and how they can get in contact with you if they have images or just want to ask you questions.
Well, thank you for that. What a great way to wrap up. My three film history related books, Henry Brandon, King of the Bogeymen, co-written with Bill Cassera, all three Bear Manor Media. So this is like a normal book. It's little, you can hold it with one hand. The other ones, you need two hands. Yeah. The first of the comedy team marketing books, Marketing Mayhem, came out last year. And they're by Richard S. Green, so it's my like authory name instead of Rick.
You didn't mention the foreword. You got a foreword by Eddie.
Eddie Deason did the foreword of Martin and Lewis, and then I got Dave Thomas from SCTV, who did the foreword for Abbott and Costello. You can get them direct from Bear Manor Media, but it's easiest probably to get them on Amazon or barnesandnoble.com. I'm loving the five-star reviews, Marketing Mayhem. They're all five-star reviews, 16 of them. And just the first one for Advertising Anarchy came last week. And they're just kind of all getting to people this week and next week. So hopefully there'll be some very nice reviews coming on that one. If you want to reach out to me, if you have collectibles on Laurel and Hardy or Universal from the 50s, don't need Bond. I'm rick.green@halo.com. And there's an E on the end of green. So rick.green with an E at halo, halo.com. And I'll get it.
Very cool. All right. Well, I want to thank you, Rick. You're a very good guest. I've never talked to you before, but I knew about you. And, you know, when your next book comes out, we'll have to have you back on again.
I would love to do it. I had a blast. And I'll close by saying I had the Martin and Lewis caricatures, which were from the Colgate Comedy Hour appearances. The Abbott and Costello caricatures done by the same guy, Bernard Ripke, are horrific looking. So I drew this myself. Based on an Al Kilgore painting. So I give Al Kilgore the basic credit, but I didn't have what I needed on ANC, so I drew it myself.
Very cool. All right. Again, thank you, Rick Green, for being my special guest. And that wraps it up for another episode of Fun Ideas Podcast, and we will see you next time.
Thank you for listening, and thank you, Rick Green, for being my special guest. Remember, you can always watch the video version of this episode on YouTube. Episode number 226 will be coming soon. If you would like to comment and or be a guest on this podcast, please drop me a line at funideas.mark@gmail.com. Become a patron of Mark Arnold and Fun Ideas Productions. If everyone listening just contributed $1 a month, that would be a tremendous help in continuing the production of my books and this podcast. Also, subscribe to my YouTube channel. The opening and closing music for the Fun Ideas Podcast is provided courtesy of Andrew the Slow Poisoner Goldfarb and is used with permission. This has been the Fun Ideas Podcast. This is Mark Arnold speaking. This episode is copyright 2022. Fun Ideas Productions. Thank you and good night.